this area, southern Ohio, Kentucky, West Virginia, has certainly been affected tremendously by substance abuse, and our advanced track is doing is on addictions this year, so we're doing a lot of thinking in that. But that's not just, it's such a significant subject that we wanted to have a session with the fundamentals track included to think about some of these issues. So this particular session, substance abuse and domestic violence, is in front of us now. It's a joy. So having said that, there's a tremendous need in our area. There's also something that's really significant in terms of what God's doing in this tri-state area. God's raising up in this year's biblical counseling training class, there are those from about 25 churches represented. You represent a variety of churches seeking to make Christ known in communities and so forth. And we rejoice in that. And times like this when we get together give us the opportunity to think about how can God sharpen us to make a difference in our local communities where we're networked and do things in ways we couldn't if we were just out there by ourselves. There's a wonderful teamwork going on in biblical counseling, and it's represented by our speaker tonight. Back in the 90s, Chris Moles was a student at Cedarville University, and for his senior internship, needed a local church to go to, and we were privileged to be that church, Wheelersburg Baptist. And that began a friendship that continues to this day with Chris and his wife, and they serve faithfully in a local church there in the chapel in Winfield, West Virginia, and we appreciate them. Chris has been a part of our biblical counseling training when we've gone on the road to Charleston, West Virginia, several times, and it's been really wonderful to see, wonderful for me to see, how God's given Chris a platform of ministry that's gone worldwide, really, in this area of domestic violence. Chris is the author of The Heart of Domestic Abuse, Gospel Solutions for Men Who Use Control and Violence in the Home. I highly recommend it. It's a really good resource. When we tried to put together this year's curriculum for the advanced track, trying to think who could we get to help us with that, I thought of Chris and was so grateful that his schedule allowed him to be here. He travels a lot. It's not easy for his schedule to coincide with what's going on here on Monday night, so we really appreciate Chris being here. And again, because of the significance of the subject, we wanted to combine so that fundamentals track could get to know Chris, as well as learn about some of the material he's going to be presenting tonight. So what's going to happen is, okay, we'll be together here this hour. Chris will be teaching. We'll take a break. Advanced track, you'll be going across the street for another session with Chris. Fundamentals track, you'll be remaining here. We'll be doing a session on guilt and forgiveness that I'll be leading. So come on up, Chris. We really appreciate you, and we're so thankful that you're here. And as I mentioned, it's being recorded, live streamed. Pass the word on to your friends, those back in your churches and so forth. They can check this out later. Hope it'll be a blessing to the body of Christ in this area. So come on up here. Can you still walk?
I can. I got this.
Man now, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, we really appreciate you being here.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Thank you, brother. I love you. All right, friends, let's get situated here. I want to make sure I've got everything I'm supposed to have. I was telling Brad I had planned to bring my car this evening, so I had all my stuff in my car, including a change of clothes, because I've been out all day. And I ran home just to get one last thing, get everything situated, and my kids had come home early from school, sick. So my wife said, take my car, it's more reliable. Like, oh, that's a great idea. And then I got here and I opened up the back, and the things I put in my car were not in the back of her car. If you can believe that, that's how it works sometimes. All right, tonight's topic is controlled and controlling, the overlap of substance abuse and domestic abuse. Now, I'm no stranger to the topic, like probably most of you guys are just as aware of the topic that Brad laid out. I have lived in West Virginia the majority of my life. I'm a native West Virginian. My family and I just recently moved back to the Moles family farm up on Red House Hill. And like many in my area, and I would assume that you guys have very similar stories, considering how rampant the opioid problem is in the tri-state area. And it's hard sometimes when I travel, and I don't talk about addiction much, but when I do, people are a little shocked, because I tell them, and you're probably in the same boat, most of the people I know somebody who has died of an overdose in the last few years. I mean, personal relationships with people. I've spent the last 20 years not only in ministry, but full-time ministry, but also working part-time in criminal corrections, not as a probation officer or anything like that. I've been an educator with parenting classes, life skills, anything I could do. And it was all biblical counseling because that's all the training I really had. But you know how it is in small towns. They'll take anybody, right? So they're not going to fire me because who's going to do it, right? So I've been involved in that world for 20 years, and I can see faces of people that I've served and ministered to and loved on. I've seen people really find hope and recovery. Sometimes, and this I say this quite a bit, sometimes through the power of the gospel, they receive transformation. That's what I want. That's what we all want. But I will settle for safety if I have to. So I've seen some people not come to know the Lord, but I've seen families safer and people sober. And the unfortunate reality is I've seen a lot of people die. And I'm assuming a lot of you guys have too. And I've seen people die in two unfortunate ways. One is through self-destruction. Very much Psalm 1, the road to destruction, just seeing people through just foolishness and sin, self-destruct. And then I've seen some other folks who've been killed at the hands of the person that should have loved them the most, should have taken care of, should have protected them. So I guess it might be helpful if I set up a little bit about why domestic abuse is kind of my niche. So in 99, I did my internship here. First time I ever heard of biblical counseling was in this church. I was just going to go into youth ministry, be a Peter Pan pastor, you know, never have to grow up, always be in youth group. It's going to be a great deal. yeah, for some reason, God did not see it the same way. But I came here and got introduced to biblical counseling, really transformed the way I viewed ministry. Also, very much like James says, you know, to him that knows to do good and doesn't do it, to him it's a sin. For me now to have that information of shepherding and soul care and not to put it into practice would have been sinful. And so God really transformed my view of ministry through my time here at Wheelersburg and just continued to pursue biblical counseling training. My master's degree is now in biblical counseling, and I'm a certified member of ACBC. I'm also a training center director for IABC. I'm a council member for the BCC. All the acronyms, basically. I've been a part of every acronym up to this point. Well, at about the same time, you know, working in corrections, I got approached about, I'd say it's about 15 years now in this particular work. I was approached about helping start a batterer intervention program, which is this idea that if you are convicted of a domestic violence crime in our county, Putnam County, or you have a protective order filed against you, you would be sentenced or could be sentenced to a class. Like you're sentenced, you wouldn't go to jail, but you'd have to do some kind of probation and then come to my class. And so I was asked early on in the process to help. A young lady who was a probation officer was going to lead the group and wanted me to be her co-lead. And she said, Chris, will you help me? She explained what was going to happen, 32 weeks with domestic abusers. And I said, no, I'm not doing that. I got my parenting class, got my life skills class. I was very happy to work with my meth addicts. Like that was my primary group. Back then was methamphetamine was rampant. Very happy to work with these guys. I don't want anything to do with domestic abuse. She asked me again, I said no. She asked me again, I said no. The last time she told me what they would pay me per hour, and I said, I think the Lord's calling me. Because frankly, I was broke as a joke, and that's what the Lord used to draw me into the work. And for 15 years now, I've been working primarily with men who perpetrate acts of violence against their intimate partners in a secular environment. But I'm a pastor and a biblical counselor, and I was told early on, hey, we want you to bring your expertise into the room. And so I've had a chance to bring the gospel into the work that we do, and that's how the book was born. I did my master's thesis on biblical counseling and the gospel and domestic violence, and that's how the book was born. And from then, as Brad said, I've been traveling all over the world. And one thing I've found is domestic violence is a pandemic. It is among the most destructive forms of violence I've ever seen. And I'm not I haven't been exposed to a lot, but as we're going to talk in the track across the street, it's the number one form of violence that children witness worldwide, more than war. It's rampant. It's believed that 1 in 3 to 1 in 4 women will experience domestic violence in their lifetime. And there's no discernible difference between those inside the church and outside the church. I think that's a shame. I really do. I think that's sinful on our part, that you can look at to your congregation, if you're a pastor, if you're standing in the pulpit area like I am, and you look out over your congregation, and you're guessing that 25% of the women, young girls to the elderly women in your church, have, currently are, or will be a victim of intimate partner violence. Now, that doesn't negate the fact that there are men who are victims. I will say that the majority of men are victims of other men when it comes to childhood sexual assault. There are some cases where women abuse men. It's far more rare than culturally we would be led to believe if you look at the research on it. So I'm real firm in this. This is a men's issue. Now, today we're going to talk about some of the ways that addictions affect it, but I really wanted to lay that out early, that when it comes to issues of domestic abuse in intimate partner relationships, we have something to say. Most of us in conservative churches are what we call complementarians. Not everybody is. You might be an egalitarian, but most people in the conservative church world are complementarians. They believe that men and women function in different roles. I actually think that gives us a great deal to say, because it is the disproportionate use of power that's the problem. Men are bigger, faster, stronger, and they abuse it, and people get hurt. If women abuse their strength, men rarely get hurt. It's just a fact. It's just the way things work, okay? So I'm not being sexist. I promise you, if we can handle men's violence against women, I will switch. I will go and spend the rest. If we can eliminate all men's violence against women, I will start fighting for men who are being violated by their wife. But I've only got time for one. So let's do the big one first. All right, so to our topic tonight, is there an overlap? Is there a correlation? The fact of the matter is that there is a correlation between the two, between domestic abuse and substances. The myth that I want to dispel tonight is that somehow substances are causing abuse. Okay, so I need to unpack a little bit about domestic abuse, and then we'll talk about the effects that substances have. Working in the criminal justice system, and if anybody in here works in that world as a social worker or probation officer, you have seen the convoluted mess that is addiction and life, right? And so there is a correlation, but I want to dispel up front the idea that somehow substances are causing the problem. So let's first unpack domestic abuse, then we'll add the substance layer to it, and hopefully this will make sense. When we're talking about domestic abuse, we're usually talking about one of three things, culturally speaking, and I will add theological layers as we go along. Spoiler alert, when it comes to topical options, topical things like this, topical discussions, there are some lectures I have that may not be, here's a scripture passage that explains it. There are very few scripture passages that explain domestic abuse or substance abuse. Agreed? Okay, three of you. It's okay that there's not a verse to attach to every problem. But does our theology speak to these issues? Greatly, right? Our theology of marriage, our theology of love, our theology of relationships, our theology of peace all speak to domestic violence, as do many of them to substances. So when we're talking about domestic abuse, we're usually talking about one of these three categories. The first one is what the world would call battering. Now, police, they use the word battering to talk about physical assault against somebody, like domestic battery, right? You can get arrested for domestic battery. When we talk about battering, we're talking about the umbrella, or what we would call coercive control. This is an ongoing use of coercive and controlling actions, including acts of intimidation and violence, targeting a victim whose safety and sanity is reduced. This is what most people talk about when they say domestic violence. It's a pattern of behavior targeting another individual that reduces their safety or their sanity. This is why I get some pushback about women being violent towards men. If I used a strategic pattern of behavior to intimidate and frighten and humiliate my wife, it would work in large part because I'm bigger, faster, stronger, and have more position and authority in the community. Does that make sense? If I did the tactics that are common of domestic violence to my wife, I would expect her to be scared, right? If she did those same tactics to me, I reckon I would be annoyed. You see the difference? So it's not just the sinful behavior. It's also the impact of that behavior that really makes this a tricky subject. It doesn't mean that women don't sin against their husbands. They do. But probably not to the same extent when it comes to domestic abuse as far as the weight. I hope that makes sense. That's why I address the idea of coercion, threat, intimidation, and fear. Now, the other form you'll likely see in the counseling room is the one that we as biblical counselors, we kind of get hung up on, and that's what we call resistive violence. This includes both legal and illegal uses of force, which are often used by victims of battering to mitigate, manage, or incite their abuser's use of coercive or controlling tactics. Meaning women who are victims will often use force against their perpetrators. I also lead groups for women who are arrested of domestic violence crimes, and about 80% on average of those women nationwide in groups like mine and anecdotally from the groups that I lead, about 80% of them are victims who have used illegal uses of force against their perpetrator. So he has used the weight of abuse for 5 years, 10 years to press down on her. One day she has enough and she stabs him with a knife. Do not stab your husband with a knife. True? Not good. You will go to jail for that. And many women do. But when you pull the rope and you ask questions, the motivation is not to coerce, control, intimidate, or create fear. The motivation is often frustration. I didn't know what else to do. I was trying to get away. Do you see the difference? Still illegal, but often from a different motivation. We don't excuse it. Like, we don't go around saying, as Christians, you really should stab your husband. That's not a homework assignment. This week, I want you to read James chapter 4 and stab your husband. We would never do that, right? However, we could teach principles like Romans 12, 1 Peter 3, what would be another? Matthew chapter 5, where the Bible talks about godly resistance and what it looks like. Because the Bible's full of passages about how to resist oppression. And then the last form is non-battery related violence. Sometimes there's neither ongoing control nor is there a response to that control. It's not innocent, but it may not fall into the above categories. This can include things like he pushed her and then she pushed him back and they go, oh no, we need help. Could be a one-time incident. There's no coercion, there's no threat, there's no control. It still might get you arrested if somebody calls the cops. But remember, we're not cops. We're not dealing with what's illegal. Because there's a lot of things in the world that are completely illegal that I think God is indifferent about. And there are some things that are legal that God's got some things to say about. Anybody? The code of the state of Ohio or the state of Kentucky or the state of West Virginia is not the Bible. So I don't bother myself too much with being an investigator. I rely on the police to do that. I spend most of my time being a biblical counselor. I hope that makes sense. I think it's important to know what we're looking at, like psychological abuse and common couples violence. It's important to know what we're looking at before we get into this piece. Do substances cause domestic violence? I would say if we were in a room filled with abusive men. So let's say you were in one of my classes and we were talking and I asked this question. So let's say I've got 12 guys who've been convicted of domestic violence, all right, from the guy who strangled his wife in the garage all the way down to the guy who threw an empty beer bottle at the wall, okay? Which, that's pretty common stuff, right? Anything in between, so just let your imagination run. And I would say, fellers, I might say it like that, country, fellers, does substances cause domestic violence? What do you think most of my guys would say? Yes, in fact, that would be the majority of the guys because many of them, in my neck of the woods and in yours, are already using substances or would find substances as a very good excuse for their violence. Now let me ask you this. If we were to go across the road or across the down the street to the victim support group, and you have the victims of all of these men in a support group talking about their identity in Christ and finding strength to speak truth and to be open to feedback and all of this stuff, and the group facilitator were to ask them, do substances cause domestic abuse? What do you think most of them might say? I think they would say yes. I think the majority of them say yes. I know most of the ladies were saying yes. So ladies, help me out. Why do you guys think the victims would also say yes? It gives them an excuse. I have found that victims and survivors, imagine this, love their husbands. And it is hard to come to grips with the reality that this person that I love, that is supposed to love me, is choosing to harm me. It'd be so much easier if something on the outside was creating this. And that makes our job a little bit difficult as biblical counselors. Because I'm going to tell you right now, we're among the few that really believe that violence begins in the heart of a perpetrator. It's not something that occurs because of genetics. It's not something that occurs because of substances. It's not something that occurs because of culture. It's not mama's fault. It's not daddy's fault. It's their choice. And therefore, from our perspective, the gospel is their only hope. Now, this may be the one area where research backs us up. There has never been, and I will contend there never will be, a pathological cause of domestic violence. You cannot find an outside substance, event, trigger, circumstance that will cause someone to target another person for abuse. You won't find it. Oh, we can have labels for it. We can label people with narcissistic personality disorder, which is personality disorder term that means that person is really, 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 really selfish. Okay, yeah, we got a word for that too. It's called pride, right? The Bible addresses that so much more thoroughly. Or the guy that came to me one time that wanted to be excused from class because he had been diagnosed with IEAD, intermittent explosive anger disorder. And I said, so every once in a while you get really, really mad. He said, yeah. And I said, is it when you don't get what you want? How'd you know, right? Because James tells me that, right? The Bible tells me that what causes fights and quarrels among us, it's our desires that work within us, right? So you are among the few, but don't be surprised. Victims will say the same thing. I'll give you another one. The general population, despite the research that's been done by people that are not believers, like to my knowledge, Dr. Bennett is not a believer, Larry Bennett. I don't know. He worked a couple scholarly articles he wrote with Patty LeBlanc, who was a... Patricia was an advocate in Alaska, but she passed away of cancer in 2015, I think. To my knowledge, Patty wasn't a believer. I've met Larry twice. I met Patty once before she passed away. To my knowledge, neither of them are believers, but they came to the same conclusions. Something's happening in these people's hearts that are leading them to violence. This is what Larry Bennett says. Although intoxication may trigger an individual episode of violence, not all who become intoxicated become batterers. It's important to note that a batterer's violence does not always stop when he stops using. There are many recovering alcoholics, addicts who continue to batter. In other words, the dilemma for the excuse of substances caused me to is that the vast majority of batterers, perpetrators of domestic violence, have perpetrated acts of abuse while sober. One of the big issues that we run into, twofold. One, is guys who use substances to excuse their violence. Once you pull the rope, you find out they were already planning to be abusive, but getting drunk before they did it, right, gave them an excuse. You guys hear where I'm coming from? It's premeditated for some guys. The other thing is, substances generally, and we'll talk about the different effects that substances have on you, in particular with this heart of violence, substances, in particular alcohol, doesn't change your values. It changes your judgment. Did you hear that? Substances generally change your judgment, not your values. What was in your heart was already there. The alcohol simply gave you permission, lowered your inhibitions to express it. I've got a cousin, don't tell him, I'm telling you this story. And if he's watching via live stream, he's not watching, he's not a believer. But I've got a cousin that when he would have too much to drink, he was going to perform, he was going to sing. Now, you would never hear him sing without alcohol. What changed? He lowered his inhibitions. The alcohol gave him permission. You see, he always thought he was a good singer. The alcohol just let him prove it. Does that make sense? Same thing with people who abuse. That's already in their heart. One of the rules, one of the things that we do, one of the line of questionings when this come up, and this, of course, is an alcohol discussion at this point, but we'll get into other substances in a moment. One of the discussions that will come up is, as I may say, well, how many drinks before you abuse your partner? Now, amazingly, some guys will calculate that. They're like, well, I'd say six, maybe seven. So six or seven drinks. How many before you hit a child? Well, I would never hit a child. How many before you shoot your grandmother? Chris, I would never do that. Okay, then it's not the drinking, right? Then I just proved my point. It's not the drinking, it's the heart. You just told me that you care more about the safety of children, right, and your grandmother's life than you do the safety and sanity of your wife. Make sense? So just keep that in mind, that guys do batter when they're sober. That's where I'm at. I always get lost. So three conditions need to be met in order to conclude that substance abuse is directly related to domestic violence. So three conditions should be met. So if you're doing data gathering, three things that you're looking for this correlation. Number one, the substance abuse must precede the battery. Number two, the relationship between substance abuse and battering must be strong enough to state that the co-occurrence is not due to chance, that one does not occur without the other. So the first thing, the substance abuse has to happen before the abuse. The second thing, the relationship has to be so strong that the co-occurrence is not due to chance. All right? And then lastly, there must be no other explanation. While I'm getting at, those are the three set down by Larry Bennett in his article. I'm just saying I've never seen that met. I've seen it come close, like the guy who would never abuse his partner when he drank beer, but that time he got a hold of moonshine only in West Virginia, right? True story. He's the first time I ever drank. Let me see if I can do a little better. Chris, the first time I ever drank moonshine, I swear, hand on the Bible, right? So he was telling me that the moonshine made him do it. Well, once we pulled the rope, we found that he had been abusive while sober. So yeah, the moonshine did something that the beer didn't do, but it wasn't producing abuse, right? It didn't allow him to remember it. So the blackout was due to the moonshine, but he had abused while sober. So just keep that in mind. So the question comes up a great deal, Chris, if this is the case, is there a link? Here are some of the things that have been found as folks have talked to both perpetrators and victims. Between a quarter and a half, between one-fourth and one-half of the women receiving victim services for domestic violence have substance abuse issues. So I would say one of the greatest correlations is the effect that substances have on victims, not the effect that substances have on perpetrators. As per usual, we tend to focus our attention on the wrong person when it comes to domestic abuse. Most of us focus on the victim. Well, why does she stay? Why does she put up with it? Why does she allow him to do that? Well, those are horrible questions. The main question is, why does he do that? Why does he abuse? And when it comes to this issue, well, does the substance make him do it? Could he help himself? Is he innocent? But really, the main issue of substance abuse and domestic violence is the way it's affecting victims. Now, I just want you to put yourself in a victim's shoes for just a moment. Maybe you are a survivor here tonight. But I want you to think about victims for a moment. And this stat, that one-fourth to one-half of victims in victim services have substance abuse problems. What would you do if you were in an inescapable relationship based on oppression? Would substances seem appealing? For me, I think they would. I think it would be a reasonable temptation that if I was living under the weight of abuse, numbness, escape might seem favorable. to living that way. Does that make sense? So it's no wonder that victims have co-occurring problems. I'll give you another thing. In our area, and I know it's true across the river, and I assume it's true here too, guys, I've worked with a lot of perpetrators who slung heroin. They were dealers, and they got their partners hooked. It's a lot easier to control your wife when you are her supplier. Now, think about the level of wickedness that would take. Not only are you poisoning our community, but you're purposely poisoning your partner to keep her under control. I can't tell you the number of victims and perpetrators we've worked with, but that was the relationship. He had become her supplier. And now she's not only dependent upon him for the drugs, right? But now he's got complete control, and she remains oppressed. So there is a correlation. Between 70 and 80% of women in substance abuse treatment, on the converse, have reported being victims of domestic violence. So now, instead of going into victim groups and finding out that up to half of them are currently using substances and 100% of them are not telling you the whole truth, just keep that in mind. Victims and perpetrators, you never get the truth. You're getting parts of the truth, okay? Victims don't know if they can trust you. Perpetrators are actively trying to deceive you. It is a game of gathering data, gathering information, building the puzzle pieces together. But we found that 70 to 80% of women in substance abuse treatment reported to being victims of domestic violence. Over 50% of the men in batterer intervention programs, this was a study done by, I think, Patty and Larry, 50% of the men in BIP programs had a substance abuse issue and are 8 times as likely to batter on the day in which they've been using. So there is a correlation. You're much more likely to escalate your use of violence while currently intoxicated, high, or under the influence. 8 times more likely. So what should that tell us if we are in a intervention position? So we're in a position where the disclosure happens while Jimbo is high. Does that give us any more responsibility to what we do? I would say yes. His likelihood of escalating to a point of lethality is much higher when he's high. Now, I want to warn you, I'm not one that promotes telling victims what to do. Victims already have a person telling them what to do. That's their abuser. She doesn't need me telling her what to do. She already has a man doing that very well. She needs me to love her, support her, resource her, give her options. She also doesn't need a savior. Jesus is much better at that than me, right? So I cannot come in to the rescue, but I will give options. And so if Jimbo is high as a kite, right, and I have the option of getting her into a safe house for the night, I'm going to offer that to her. Make sense? Now, if she doesn't want to take it, that is her decision, right? Unless I witness Jimbo coming to the church trying to kill both of us, I'm probably not obligated to call the cops, at least not in West Virginia. It could put her in more danger. I want to respect her. But in that case, if he's high as a kite, I'm going to offer her immediate safety resources because I know he's 8 times more likely to escalate his use of violence, including to a scale of lethality. If I know that maybe in the past he's displayed weapons or he's abused the pets or he strangled her, then my red flags are going way up. Is this making sense? Yeah, so the risk is really high when we add substances to our discussion. All right, half of the partnered men entering substance abuse treatment on the other side battered in the past year. This was a striking contrast. We expect the BIP participants, those convicted of domestic violence, to acknowledge some level of substance abuse and that it's going to affect their battering. But when the researchers asked the questions of men entering the same substance abuse programs like they asked the women, they found that half of them were willing to disclose they had battered in the previous year. So we have to acknowledge a correlation. We know that substances don't cause domestic abuse, but they certainly contribute. Anybody? So we have to see that there's a connection. Not that one causes the other, but that they certainly feed off each other like gasoline on a fire. The drunken bum perspective on intimate partner violence is limited in several ways. So this is something that was very common, right? batterers are just, they're guys, they're just bums. This is how the temperance movement really gained weight in the United States. You guys, history, remember history class? The way I was taught it was that the temperance movement partnered with the progressive movement because the progressives wanted income tax, right? And the temperance folks wanted to get the tax off of alcohol because the government depended too much on the alcohol tax so that they could get prohibition. Nobody taught you this? So the uber-liberal progressives and the uber-conservative temperance folks joined forces to pass the income tax and to get prohibition on alcohol. It was a win-win, which I think everybody lost at that point because we got Al Capone and income tax. But right, the idea of the temperance movement was alcohol was creating violent men. You can go back and read through a lot of the material, and you'll see that as a constant theme, that alcohol was creating this rageful man. Well, the drunken bum perspective on intimate partner violence is limited. First, the relationship between substance abuse and intimate partner violence is strongest for those men who already think abuse is appropriate in certain situations. Did you catch that? This is a secular researcher who acknowledges that it's, we do what we do because we want what we want. We want what we want because we think what we think. He's already acknowledging that it's strongest for men who already think that it's appropriate. One study found that when the endorsement of men's dominance was considered, the correlation between substance abuse and IPV, intimate partner violence, disappeared. In other words, the greatest contributor to men's violence against women is what men think about women. Did you catch that? It's not what they put in their bodies. It's what they think about women. Now, I don't know about you, but the world would tell us that what we need is equality. I love equality. I don't think we'll ever achieve it. Equity, I don't think, is something that we're ever going to achieve. But I wonder if our theology of people being made in the image of God would affect change. What do you think? I wonder if our theology about marriage and the call of God on husbands, on how they're to treat their wives, would have an effect. I think so. I think our theology is superior, right, to the deficiencies of a fallen world. And that's all Larry is noticing. There's no discernible difference between how much money somebody makes, what color skin they have. The reality is, if a man, a husband, views his wife as less than, he tends to abuse her. Third, one of the things he found that was interesting is the amount of alcohol used prior to most episodes of intimate partner violence that involved alcohol was less than imagined. In a 1990 study, which was the premier study of alcohol-related violence, the average amount of alcohol consumed prior to a violent episode was only about an ounce. Did you catch that? An ounce, which is enough for him to maintain control of his faculties and also enough to blame the alcohol. An ounce, that's a glass of wine. That's a can of beer. That's all we're talking about. And yet that's being used as a prominent excuse. All right. Hey, let's do some scripture. I told you we'd get to the Bible eventually. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 6 that no one can serve two masters. Either they'll hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Now, I'm not suggesting that this guy's trying to serve God and a substance. I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm suggesting he's attempting to serve himself, and God stands in the way of that. That's where the idolatry lies. He's not an idol worshiper of a substance. A substance is convenient for him. A substance works for him. At this point, if he's a batterer, if he's an abuser, the idol is himself. Does that make sense? He's really torn. He's what the Bible would call a double-minded man. What the Bible would call a double-minded man. Let me get square on my notes here because I want to make sure we have the same notes. All right. Yep, we don't. I put these after, so let me do these for us since they're in your notes this way. So one of the potential landmines for biblical counselors is the temptation to address only the addiction as the root. The reality is the addiction and the violence are symptomatic of the heart. Do you guys know what I mean by that? I get this a lot. I have victims in particular. And listen, you do this work long enough, everybody's going to hate you. If everybody loves you at the same time, you're doing it wrong. Okay? If the perpetrator likes you and the victim hates you, you're really doing it wrong. Right? If you should expect the perpetrator to hate you now and then. You should expect him to like you now and then because he's going to try to schmooze you. You should expect the victim to love you until you don't meet her expectations. Then she's going to hate you. So if everybody loves you, you're doing it wrong. All right? I cannot tell you the number of angry letters and emails that I've gotten over this topic. But here's one of the things that victims request a lot. Help him get sober. Help him get clean. Because victims are believing the same lie that our culture believes and the same lie that perpetrators are telling us, that it's the substance. And biblical counselors have fallen into this trap time and time again. I do believe that these are co-occurring issues, but I also believe in all the work I've done with perpetrators, they are very happy to have you work with them on their sobriety. In fact, it may sound like this. None of this would have happened if I hadn't touched that stuff, Pastor Chris. I'm telling you. I'm so glad you're here. I'm committed to this. Sobriety. See my family restored, right? See my marriage healed. I'm excited. I'm going to be clean, walking straight and narrow, yada 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 yakety smackety, all right? Perpetrators are very happy to deal with the secondary problem. And I do believe the addiction is the secondary problem, all right? Now, if they were my primary counselee, I get it. But this is where I break from traditional biblical counseling. When I'm working with a perpetrator, my counselee is not the perpetrator. My counselee is the victim. I've believed that for years. It's been very effective for me. Yes, I'm dealing with a perpetrator, but he knows right from the very beginning. I am here because I love your wife. I am here because God loves your wife. I love you too, right? But I'm not here for you. Because his agenda is usually marriage restoration, right? Getting things back to normal. Our agendas completely clash. I would love to see your marriage restored, but I am not here for that. My key focus for restoration is to see you restored to God and your wife restored to safety. And then maybe we can talk about marriage stuff. But I am not willing to fight for your marriage so that you can go back and continue to oppress your wife. I'm just not. That's not a marriage. You've continually broken the covenant. You've continually lied to her. You've continually oppressed her. Why in the world would I try to fix that? That was awful. I would much rather start over once we get all of this stuff. Does that make sense? So I'm very firm on that. So my primary counselee is usually his wife, and I'm right up front with that. I want your wife to be safe. I want her to be secure. I don't want her to live in fear. I want you to honor God, right? God's glory. I don't care if you're happy. You've been happy for too long, and it was awful. You're the only one, okay? So we're not going to do it your way. We're going to do it God's way. So the landmine, the potential landmine, is that we look at the problem in front of us, the alcohol, the stimulant, the substance, the pornography, the gambling, whatever addiction it is, as the primary problem, rather than seeing as primary problem of one of the heart, okay? So let's walk through just a couple of these. How does domestic violence manifest in conjunction with specific addictions? How does it manifest when it comes to specific addictions? I've already talked enough about alcohol because that's the primary example. That's the one that tends to make the most sense. But let's talk about stimulants, amphetamines, and cocaine. You don't hear a lot about cocaine anymore. Meth is so much cheaper. And drugs, as you all, I'm sure, know, is a matter of economics. It always has been, and that's why we always fail at treating it, because what we try to do is we try to legislate against the substance, and all we do is we create a new market. So if you recall, we came down hard on crack. You remember that? Crack is whack, right? We came down hard on crack, and what happened was people found that they could make amphetamines at home that had the same effect as cocaine. And that's where meth came from. And then we had this massive meth problem. I'm sure you guys remember that. It's coming back. because of how we're restricting heroin, meth is beginning to come back. Now it's all shake and bake. Have you guys seen that stuff? I saw a Gatorade bottle that a police officer had. You know how Gatorade bottles are, right? It was so blown up with gas, it looked like a basketball, where a person had tried to make shake and bake meth in their trunk of their car. I was like, holy cow. Like, that's how it's all popped out like that. So meth's making a comeback. So stimulants, amphetamines, how do they affect us? Well, obviously, they have an effect on our function, right? So if you know anything about methamphetamine, what might be some of the risks to a victim if their partner's using meth? What might come to your mind? Anything? Bueller? Hello? Okay, rage. Methamphetamine users are usually, they're really wound up. Like, I had one lady that was on meth, one of my parenting class ladies. She said, I don't even like the way it makes me feel. I just like that I get my house clean. And I was like, well, becoming a zombie is not a good reason to, you know, cleaning your house. Just clean your house slower, right? But it just hops us up. And so rage can be part of that. I have worked with methamphetamine users who, especially when they're coming down or when they're jonesing, when they want more, right, have been incredibly violent with people. Okay? Heroin's even worse, believe it or not. But amphetamines run a great deal of risk because of hyperactivity, delusional stuff, delusions of grandeur. You'll see quick tempers with methamphetamine. A lot of denial, minimization, right? You know, it's not that big a deal. Like, I once worked with a guy, God bless him, he had just peeled most of his face off at this point. You guys have seen that back in the day. And he just would pick. But he didn't have a problem. I had the problem, right? I was the problem. So stimulants, they get you up, obviously, but they can also affect other people negatively. Marijuana, most people would say there's never been a batterer on marijuana. Chris, you are crazy. If anything, we need to give all the batterers marijuana so that everybody's chill, right? Because it's traditionally associated with being mellow. But the reality is, I've never heard of anybody overdosing on marijuana to the point of death, but I have known people who've overdosed on marijuana to the point of hallucinations. Not to mention the fact that I have seen so many guys over the years who have rejected Jesus but embraced pot to the point of becoming lazy and passive, and through neglect continue to abuse their spouse. Oh yeah, they weren't angry or rageful, but they were do-nothings. Because every time there was conflict, their answer was to address it? No, to toke, to escape, to get away. So there is a co-occurring issue even with drugs that are meant to bring you down. Because it's really not a matter of the substance, right? It's what's happening in your heart. Many of the guys I've worked with have turned to pot as their alternative or their answer. Why? Because they don't want to deal with conflict. They don't want to be uncomfortable. I cannot tell you the number of men that I've had hard conversations with, firm conversations with, that the bottom line was, I don't like that. Like, well, that's like 90% of being a husband. Like, that's the majority of being married, right? Is I don't like that, but I got to deal with that. I got to live with that. I have to endure that. Not to mention when they claim to be Christians. Holy cow, right? Well, what, you became a Christian for your life to be easier? Have you read the Bible, right? Heroin, of course, is the big one in our area. And there are risks and there are some things associated with heroin that are specific. Of course, right, the meth addiction, the meth problem got really bad, so we legislated against Sudafed. So now you can't treat your cold, right? And then what happened? We had doctors prescribing OxyContin like it was bubble gum. And then smart people got the idea, hey, if I crush this up and snort it, or if I cook it and shoot it in my veins, it's a lot faster. And then when we restricted that, started arresting doctors, well, heroin. And now we're cracking down the heroin, so we got this fentanyl nonsense. We got stuff that people use to put elephants to sleep, and our kids are shooting it up, and they're dying. I once had a guy, and this is where heroin comes into the mix. I once had a guy in my class, and he said, Chris, if you held a bag of dope over a bridge and you held my family over that same bridge, I would have picked the bag of dope every time. Every time. And it wasn't because he loved heroin. He would have done just as well with OxyContin. He would have done just as well probably with meth before that, even though that's the opposite effect. What did he love? He loved escape. He loved himself. He loved feeling better. He loved not feeling bad. That's eventually what happens with heroin addicts, right? First, I do it to feel good, and now I have to do it to not feel bad. Because if you had a bag of dope in my family, I would have choose the bag of dope every time. Victims are really at a high risk with heroin users when they're jonesing for more because of that very fact, right? I have to have it. So you guys know. I mean, some of you guys probably, God bless you, you've probably had people in your home that have used, maybe had things stolen from you. I mean, you know the effects that this garbage is having on our people. And so you have to imagine when you add that level of stress and narrow-mindedness into a relationship, it's going to escalate patterns of behavior, thought, and beliefs that have already placed people in danger. So now when you're jonesing for heroin, you are at an increased risk. Sexual addiction, I see this probably the most in my biblical counseling world, working with perpetrators. I get this all the time. Guys want help with porn because they think that, you know, that's what's broken their relationship. But then you talk to the victim and they're like, yeah, I hate that he uses porn, and I hate worse that he abuses me. But there is a correlation, right? Now, I've had a lot of people say to me that their use of porn teaches them to devalue women. I would actually contend that you probably devalue women prior to using porn at that level. Because the image of God implanted on that person, and yeah, it does affect how you view your partner and how you view them sexually. But I think they are symptoms of the same cause, the same problem, which again comes back to pride. I hope this is making sense. So when I'm presented with a sexual addiction, I'm really not diving into the porn addiction. I'm diving into the heart of violence if he's seeing me for abuse. Because I think addressing the heart of violence and seeing it replaced with the mind of Christ, which is another lecture altogether, Philippians chapter 2, I think that ultimately is the solution to the problem. First, the gospel. Do they know Jesus, have a relationship with him? If they do and can come to that place, then they have something to put off and something to put on. But that putting off and putting on is not stop hitting the dog, stop punching holes in the wall, and start patching it with spackle. No, that's not the put off, put on. It's putting off the heart of violence and putting on the mind of Christ. Putting on the desires for self, putting on the desires to glorify God. Make sense? And then I think those behaviors will begin to change, including the pornography addiction. Gambling as well. I've seen many men destroy their families for the love of money, success, fame, for the sake of winning. I often remind guys of, what is it, 1 Timothy 5:8? If anybody doesn't take care of his own family, he's worse than an unbeliever. I've had guys, I swear, folks, I've had guys look right at me who refuse to pay child support out of some sense of revenge. I can't believe she's doing this to me. I'll show her. At the same time, claiming to be a believer. And I have to be honest with them. And I'm just telling you, these are some of the conversations you have to have. I don't buy it. If you are a believer, you're a really ignorant one. And we're going to fix that in about 5 minutes. Right? Because what you're choosing is not the choice a believer would make. No matter how hurt you feel, your kids need you. Your wife needs this. No matter how slighted you feel, the fact that the court had to do this, yeah, I could see where that would make you feel bad. But that's what we got. You have to take care of your family. I hope that makes sense. And gambling is the opposite of that. All right. In a couple minutes, let's finish all of this, all these notes, how many ever we have. I can do that. All right, so you saw the loving two masters. You know James, the double-minded man. He's like a wave on the sea. I'll use verses like this. I use Psalm 1 a lot too, because I do think men who batter are so desperate to control their spouse, they've completely lost control of their own life. And there are things over here that are completely out of control. That's one of the reasons why addictions are so common. And obviously, the power of the Holy Spirit isn't present, at least not in his fullness, or they would be able to practice self-control. It's actually a very glaring target, very glaring help for us to say you lack self-control because you're spending way too much time trying to control another person. God didn't create you for that. You're double-minded. You're like the chaff in Psalm 1. You're getting blown every direction. You need to be rooted. You need to be grounded. You need to uproot the heart of pride, replace it with the mind of Christ. You need stability at its most foundational level. So we try to identify the problem or the problems. The heart desires more of what it wants. The heart wants more and will briefly be satisfied. At the root, both addiction and domestic abuse are about idolatry. The addict is in bondage to a substance while dominating his wife as well. Each represent a need for the gospel, for gospel transformation, including confession, repentance, and transformation. I don't have time to lay all that out. One of the big misses and one of the calls that I have to all of us as biblical counselors, do not rush this. We are rushing repentance without testing it. And we have way too many relationships that we're pushing back towards reconciliation that are not ready. Just because a guy cries in your office does not mean he's repentant, especially if he's abusive. One of the hallmarks of abuse is manipulation. And do not think that he will not do everything in his power to coerce you in order to get what he wants. If you're an obstacle, he will bowl you over. You have to stay firm. You have to stay strong and resilient. I love Ephesians 4. I use that all the time. When's a liar no longer a liar? When he's a truther. That does not happen overnight. One true statement does not make you a truther. Hello? When's a thief no longer a thief? When he's a generous person. That doesn't mean that he steals from somebody and gives it to somebody else. That does not make him generous. He's still a thief. He has to work. He's got to earn some money. Then he has to give it away and give it away again and give some away again. And once the community sees him as generous, he'll be known as generous. When's an abuser no longer an abuser? It's not when he says, I'm sorry, can I please go back home? He may be repentant. Only God knows. But the church is called to the fruit of repentance. When Paul looked at the Corinthians, he said, what earnestness, what indignation, what zeal, what passion. I saw all of this in you guys. Overnight? No. It takes time. The addict may use his addiction to maintain control over his partner, as I said, using it to justify his violence, using as a direct form of abuse, like getting her hooked, introducing his partner to substances as a means of keeping her dependent. We address the problem. We also address the motives. You guys know this, Biblical Counseling 101 from James 4. We know that control is often the goal of abuse. Now, batterers will rarely say they want control. They'll usually say something like, I just wanted peace, which I can work with, because most sinful people that ask for peace don't know what peace is. They think peace is the absence of problems. Suckers. Peace is the presence of Christ. That's why I love Philippians 4, right? When you take your request to God, he promises you what? The peace of God. But when you begin to practically live it out by changing the way you think, the doctrines that you believe, the life that you live, then what are you promised? The God of peace will be with you. And then what do you learn? Down by verse 13. To be content. I coach high school basketball. We were in our version of the state championship this past week. We came in ranked number one. We got upset in the semifinals by a team we had beaten pretty handily during the season. They just outcoached us, slowed us down. We're a running team. The next night in the third place game, we scored 95 points, which is what we do, won the game. Our whole philosophy is try to catch us, right? But the other team, they were big and strong, had a big old boy, really good ball player, slowed us down. We both took 59 shots. Both teams had 17 rebounds. They shot 63%, we shot 60%. Shooting 60% is great. But when you shoot the same amount of shots, the other team shoots 63, you lose by a handful of points, right? I was in charge of devotions that night. I shared this verse, Philippians 4:13, with the team. Had a different devotion plan because I thought we'd win. Because Philippians 4:13 is not about when Steph Curry puts on his shoes and wins the championship. It's the year he put it on his shoes and he lost the championship. Because the peace of God and peace with God and the God of peace can grant you contentment. That's the secret. I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. Even lose a basketball game, even struggle in my relationships, even have problems in my life, even being uncomfortable. I have that level of strength, which is a lot more powerful than the strength that maybe our guy's been using to control. And then, of course, we promote the mind of Christ. And you've got Philippians 2 there. Paul does not simply command us to be humble. In Philippians 2, I believe he gives us a course in humility. I have an entire lesson that I walk through in small groups of men based on Philippians chapter 2. We want to compare and contrast this man's abusive behavior, controlling motivation, with the mind of Christ. I call it a tree model. I use Luke chapter 6. I usually build this big tree model over the course of several months, taking his behavior, his motives, his beliefs, and then contrasting them with Jesus. And then asking him, if you really have a relationship with Jesus, if the gospel is really effective at transformation, what should it produce in your life moving forward? Instead of wanting control, what should you want? Instead of believing that you're superior, what should you believe? Instead of behaving the ways you did behave, how should this affect your behavior? Because we're looking at how this man relates ultimately to God, to others, and self. Now, obviously, I'm a good biblical counselor. I would hope. I don't believe that the Great Commandment has three commands. I think it's only got two. I really believe that. But I do think there's three perspectives. I do believe it's important to have a proper view of who you are. And the old preacher was correct. There is a God. Anybody? And you're not him. And it's important for abusers in particular to understand that. To put God in his proper place, others in their proper place, and themselves in proper perspective. To be sober-minded. Not to think of themselves more highly than they ought. They need to think of themselves, but properly. They've been thinking of themselves way too highly. Right? It's time to get a proper perspective. So I have rushed through that. We could go on and on and on and on and on, but we've got to be close to time, right? 7:15? Yeah. So I appreciate you guys, and I'm going to be hanging around. I'm going to be doing another lesson here in a minute, but then I'll hang around a little bit after if anybody's got questions and stuff. But we're going to do some questions now.
Yeah, let's do a few questions now since the fundamentals track, this will be their only opportunity to interact. Questions that you have for Chris tonight, anybody?
I guess we did cover it all.
How about some resources that you would recommend? I know you got lots of resources for those that want to learn more about violence, churches, what churches can do, and so forth.
So there's a book called The Heart of Domestic Abuse. Actually, I would recommend, there are usually three books I recommend for churches who are investigating or researching, especially leaders who want to know more about domestic abuse. The first is by Justin and Lindsay Holcomb. It's called Is It My Fault or Is It Your Fault? Is It My Fault? Is It My Fault? I think it gives a great primer of what domestic abuse is. I don't think it's exhaustive. It's not the final word. I think they could have said a lot more. But what I love about it is it's a great introduction for pastors and biblical counselors. So Is It My Fault by Justin and Lindsay Holcomb. If you want to know more about perpetrator intervention, I have to recommend my book because I think it's the only one of its kind. The Heart of Domestic Abuse deals primarily with what's happening in the heart of a man who perpetrates acts of abuse. And then from a victim perspective, I recommend Called to Peace by Joy Forrest. Called to Peace by Joy Forrest. Joy is a biblical counselor in North Carolina and a certified advocate with North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence. She tells her survivor's story and then weaves biblical truth in for other victims to hear. And it is hard to read, but I think it's really powerful to see a victim's perspective. One last resource that was just released this year that may be a good overview for the church, and it's a free curriculum that you can implement, that was developed by the Southern Baptist Convention last year. I was privileged to be on the team. Not everyone on the team was biblical counselors. I think you would consider three or four of us, Brad Hambrick, myself, Darby Strickland. I would consider Leslie Burnick, some would not. But there were also Christian counselors, social workers, police officers. And that's called Becoming a Church That Cares Well.
and it has a book that you can get for $2 from Lifeway. They just sell it for cost, a soft cover book. And if you go to churchcares.com, there you can sign up for the free video series. It's a 12-part, 20-minute video series. I'm featured in some of them, so you can, hey, I know that fella. But each of the contributors, we basically walk through the content of the book, and we talk about child abuse, sexual abuse, domestic abuse, how to work with law enforcement, guardians ad litem if you're in child abuse work. So it's a really nice little rubric to take your church through.
So let me ask this question. In the fundamentals track, there might be someone here saying, I'm just learning about the counseling. I'm learning the Bible has answers to the problems. Now you're starting to talk about domestic violence. And okay, I guess I can see that's a problem out there. Chris, are you saying that domestic violence, I mean, there's 26 churches represented in this group. Domestic violence might be in our church. I've never even thought about that before. So address that.
Yeah. So how many churches? 26?
26
churches? Then there are at least 26 cases. I mean, yes. Yes, domestic abuse is happening in your church. It's just, it'd be too amazing if there wasn't a case in your church. And I'm just telling you this as somebody who loves you, who's been in this work for a long time, and I'm a pastor. And I can tell you we just merged with another church, and so we're in this really interesting situation where I went from pastoring a church of 30 to a church of 90. And I can tell you right now, in a church of 90, I know there are victims, past victims, because I've talked to them, so there's survivors in my church. But I know that there's somebody. I know there is. It hasn't been disclosed yet. And so, for me, I don't know the current case, but I would suspect that it's happening. And so I just want to be presentable, kind, available, teachable. Now, I will add this, and this may be, we'll have to see 20 years from now if this is true. I do think that because my church knows what I do, and I'm so actively involved in the work, and like most people don't know me as a pastor. Most people know me as the domestic violence guy, which is a weird thing. I may, in fact, be a deterrent, to be honest with you. The fact that I'm a pastor that's so highly engaged in the work, you'd have to be pretty brazen, I think, to stay in the church. But there's no guarantee. Absolutely. Absolutely.
That message also gets out that this isn't a place you're going to get under the rug, so to speak. Yeah. This domestic violence.
I would say if you want to hear a really good presentation on that perspective, last week at the Faith, 2 weeks ago, at the Faith Biblical Counseling Training Conference, I don't know if you saw it, Steve Byers did a plenary, Thursday night plenary, called Helping the Church Respond to Cases of Abuse. And he listed 12 things that churches can do. Most of them were not directly related to abuse. It was things like have a healthy view of church membership, be very firm, practice church discipline, right? Biblical counseling and care. He was discipleship, value the gospel. And he laid out how those things can be a deterrent. Because if you have a high level of accountability where you know that sin is handled well by a church, then it would be a deterrent. And so, yeah, I would agree. I think if you have a high view of Scripture, but not just that, your practical theology supports it, it would put folks on notice who are there to hide, or more so, most of the time, batterers who claim to be Christians that don't repent, they're there to take over. A lot of times you'll see them in leadership. Quite frankly, I think we've seen this in our culture with the bully pastors. I think you're seeing that more and more, a number of pastors who are beginning to be exposed because they have that same heart. Because they care more about controlling people than they do about shepherding people.
Questions you think would affect the majority? I know there's lots of, hey, I'm facing this particular problem. Thank you.
Yeah, so it would be distinct. Yeah, so the question is, you know, you're in a situation where one member of the couple is attending your church and the other does not, or is unsaved. And you're not convinced that you can or should inform law enforcement because you haven't witnessed criminal activity and you feel like you're going to put the victim in more danger, which is a very common situation. So it would depend upon which person, which party was in the church, somewhat. But I usually say we want to value victim concerns, right? We want to honor victims' requests, and we want to honor the law, right? So we want to make sure we're legally doing what we're supposed to do, Romans 13. But then as people who are Romans 12 people, and we're supposed to live at peace with everyone, we can't sit idly by, right? So we have to engage in peacemaking. So I would want to talk to the victim as soon as possible, or have a godly lady speak to her as soon as possible, as safely as possible, to see what she wants, what she needs. And then I would have resources available for a variety of different things. I just had a conversation with a young lady who, for lack of a better term, was kidnapped by her boyfriend not long ago, but wasn't convinced she was in an abusive relationship. And so we were able to meet, and one of the things we did was walk through some scriptures, pray together, and then I showed her a tool called the Power and Control Wheel, developed by an agency in Minnesota. It's a secular agency, but it's all observational. And I said, hey, here's what victims of domestic violence have commonly experienced. Have you experienced any of these? And we walked through each one, and of the nine, she had eight. And so just because of having a conversation, she was in there going, I'm a victim of domestic violence. And I was able to say, I knew right away, but I wanted you to know. Can I help you? And that's when we're able to give resources. So I would really look to the victim to give resources, but then honor that. I would say they are contributive, not causative. So for instance, you could have a set of male twins raised in the same environment with identical genetics, and one could choose to be an abuser and one could choose to be safe. They're not destined. Now that choice might be easier for some. Yeah, I would say people can be... So I would say the research would show, and I think Mark Shaw would be a good one to ask this question of, but my understanding is that addiction can alter your physiology. I view it kind of a lot like type 2 diabetes. You might be predisposed to it, but it's treatable through your behavior, right, as opposed to type 1 diabetes. Addiction can change your physiology after you've introduced a substance to your body. But prior to that, there still is a great level of choice. The same studies on twins would be a good example of that, where one twin, genetically identical to the other, has an addiction problem while the other has no addiction problem. So there is definitely a level of choice, responsibility, and exposure. Obviously, once you're exposed to a subject, like a substance like heroin, for instance, you're going to be more predisposed to using again, right, because it is going to feel good, you're going to want, and then once you consume it enough, you're going to need it because you're going to develop a dependency. The video series? Or Steve, becoming a church that, is that right? No, wait, hold on. Responding well, helping the church respond to abuse. Steve Byers. The other video I would recommend to you that just came out, I forget all the projects I've been working on, but this would be a great one for you guys. IBCD, the Institute for Biblical Counseling and Discipleship, IBCD.org. They just released a counseling observation series featuring myself and Jeremy Pierre, who's a professor at Southern Seminary, on domestic abuse. I'm the counselor, Jeremy is the perpetrator, and in that we have three sessions of counseling, but we have nine sessions total because I insisted on having team meetings where I sat down with the pastor along with an advocate And then we have a round table at the end where we all come out of character. And it was totally extemporaneous. Jeremy knew what he was doing. I was winging it. It was terrifying. But very beneficial. I've been getting nothing but positives. And so if you want to see my process from a small scale, it's pretty close to my process.
Your website and other places?
Yeah. ChrisMoles.org is my website. On there I have a blog. I podcast every week. I have just 111 will drop tomorrow, episode 111. So I podcast every week on the subject of domestic abuse. Never in my wildest dreams. I just did that because people kept asking me questions and I couldn't take all the phone calls. And now almost 4,000 people listen to that podcast every week. I have a membership site for biblical counselors and lay people called Peaceworks University. We have about 150 members. That's a pay-to-play option where we give resources. There's over 100 hours of video on that site now. And we meet once a month in a live Q&A. I give toolbox items, homework assignments. If I come up with something, we give it to them. And so this month, for instance, I sat down with Ben Marshall from Canyon Hills. They went from a church having an increase in abuse disclosures to a church that now trains all of their small group leaders how to identify and properly refer abuse up the chain of command. And he gave us all their resources. So I've got a masterclass interview with him that just dropped this month for our members. And now I've got hundreds of pages of resources that his church has worked on that I'm distributing to all my members now so they can take it to their churches and implement something similar.